Hey, folks, this is Kevin. On this episode, you'll hear Carrie Poppy.
So we're both looking for bathhouses in San Francisco, trying to find someone named Math, and both of us are coming up dry. And,
That and more. But before that, I just want to say, you guys might know Chris Castiglione created the Risk website. And one of the main reasons he was an irreplaceable part of the team was that he taught himself how to code. And now he's developed this brilliant and incredibly user-friendly class called 1 Month HTML that'll teach you how to code in less than a month. Coding is the most desired job skill out there now. Everyone wants a website, and being able to do it yourself is real empowerment. 1 Month HTML is the easiest way to learn code. You build an actual website, you'll be welcomed into a community of over 12,000 people. There's hours of easy-to-follow videos, hands-on exercises and training, and the best part, if you get stuck, there's always someone there to help you out. So enroll now at 1month.com/risk. Enrollment's typically $99, but if you join now, you'll get a one-time discount of 25% off, and you'll be helping to support Risk. Again, it's 1 month HTML, 30 minutes a day for 30 days, and you'll be able to code HTML and CSS on your own. 1month.com/risk. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Bacalao behind me now. Unless, of course, that's not how you pronounce their name. Today's episode is live from Max FunCon. Now, as you know, Risk is a proud member of the Maximum Fun network of podcasts, and a few times a year, Jesse Thorne, who is the founder of Max Fun and the host of Jordan Jesse Go and Bullseye, throws a big party. This one, Max Fun Con, that happens out west, happens at Lake Arrowhead. And it's for anyone who loves Max Fun shows, as well as lots of comedians and writers come. So this year, Jesse thought it would be fun to have Risk at Max Fun Con, up on top of a mountain at Lake Arrowhead. And when I got to the top of that mountain, I was immediately so nauseous and dizzy. You know, I suffer from positional vertigo on occasion, and I didn't realize that high altitudes like that would make it kick in the way it did. I arrived, was immediately bedridden, and could not host the show. But fortunately, Beowulf Jones was there, who hosts the show out in Los Angeles at the Nerd Melt Theater normally, so he took over the reins for me. For this episode, we're going to play three of the stories that were performed that night, but I'll tell you, Jonathan Ames, the author and the guy who produces the show Bored to Death on HBO, he told a beauty of a story, but is not so sure he wants us to run it. So if you ever run into Jonathan Ames, tell him, oh, please, 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 one day, let the Risk podcast run that story you told. In any case, the three we do have to present to you today are just wonderful. So let's get to it. This is Risk live at Max FunCon.
I'm Beowulf Jones. And I did not expect to be here either.
You know how every sitcom has that episode where there's the high school rock fest, and then right as they're about to go on, someone has laryngitis, and they're like, Kirk Cameron, it has to be you? Tonight, I am Kirk Cameron. Thank you. Thank you. Subway sandwiches all around for everyone. So thank you so much for coming to Risk. I am the host of the LA show over at Nerd Melt with Sarah Benincasa. And yes, the perks of doing this show were, one, I get to do a show with Kevin, and two, I finally don't have to host. But Jesse already made that joke. And I'm a little bitter because the amount of time, like from when you guys sat down in the chair to when this show started, that's more time than I had to write a monologue. So I was really counting on that joke. That was my opener. But no, we're going to persevere. We'll get through it. We'll get through it. I have a text from Kevin, which he would like me to... Are you guys big Kevin fans? Okay, this is, wow, extra. This is being recorded, and Kevin will listen to it, and I know he feels horrible about not being here. So on the count of three, can we all say, Kevin Allison, we love you? Is that something we can do here? Okay. One, two, three. Kevin Allison, we love you! Now, guys, this is a message from Kevin. My beloved Max Funsters, first let me just say you look terrific. I like what you've done with your beard. I'll just go ahead and assume you feel the same way about mine. It truly pains me to say that I arrived at this gorgeous place this afternoon feeling a little weird in the head. That is to say, weirder than usual. Then I started sweating a bit more than you might find sexy and began to feel a little, shall we say, barfy. It occurred to me that if I were to host Risk tonight, and God forbid, barf on some of you, it would be a lot like what my friends in the BDSM community call a Roman shower. Roman shower fan, front row. But still, the chances are slim I would hit the one or two of you who are undoubtedly kinked that way, and I like to keep things consensual. And in any case, what do you mean, we keep things consensual at Maximum Fun. In any case, my good friend Beowulf is a delightful fellow. Thank you. And this... All right, that's more appreciation than any audience has ever shown me ever. And that's what Risk is about. People coming together. In any case, my good friend Beowulf is a delightful fellow, and the stories we've planned for tonight are full of laughs, chills, and tears. So you're in for a treat. And if I'm feeling better tomorrow, and if any of you are gay, Asian, and male, please rest assured I want to lick your butt. Yours in feverish weirdness. Let's talk about the butt licking. I think that's the natural thing to stem off from. Do you guys know that in addition to performing, Kevin is also a teacher? He was actually my teacher. I took a sketch writing class from him, and I took a class on storytelling, but he teaches a new class now. I'm not making this up. The class is called Everything You Can Do to an Ass Other Than Fuck It. And when I heard that, I thought, Kevin, that is ridiculous. There is no need for that class. There's so many things you can do to an ass. You can lick it. You can slap it. And then I drew a blank. I could not think of a single other thing to do with an ass. I'm like, fuck, I have to take this class. And I don't want to take this class. I am not a member of the BDSM community. I get all those needs filled through listening to Kevin's stories. But Kevin and I get along very well because we both have very flawed logic, which, you know, I just remember, this is a memory coming back to me. We were at the People's Improv Theater in New York once, and we wanted to smoke a joint. So I was like, okay, let's just go to the bathroom and smoke. And he's like, well, don't you think people will think it's weird that we're going in the bathroom? And I said, no, they'll just think we're doing coke. And he was like, oh, okay, well, let's go then. But I am so happy to be here. We have such an incredible show for you guys. So what do you say? Should we quit my spiel and just get on with the show? All right. I am so excited for our first performer of the evening. He is an NPR host of State of the Reunion. And also, you guys, this is so cool. He was on Deaf Poetry. He is a great guy. I'm so happy to have him on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Al Letson.
Hey, hey, hey. I escaped from Florida, too. Where are my Florida peoples in the house? I mean, thank you, sir. Good to see you. Glad you got away. So yeah, my name is Al Letson. I do a lot of different things, but I wasn't always called Al Letson. When I was a kid, everybody called me Alfie. Let me tell you, like, it was torture because that was like not too long after the Michael Caine movie came out, and everybody would sing, "What's it all about, Alfie?" You know this song. Please don't ever sing it again. Anyway, so as a kid, I was an only child. I was pretty lonely. I like to think of myself as the original Calvin and Hobbes. Like, I had like this crazy imagination. And for the most part, I entertained myself. But in my little six-year-old heart, I had a deep, deep longing desire. I wanted a sibling so bad. I mean, like, it was all I talked about, all I dreamed about. I needed to have somebody that could play with me, someone that we could have fun with. And at 6 years old, I really didn't know much about how that worked. I just knew that I had to talk to my parents to make it happen. And I'm really comfortable with saying, like, I was one of the cutest kids ever. But I was also one of the most irritating little fucks ever. And I could talk so much and so long. So I just talk, then begged my mom and dad, please, 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 please. Until one day they decided that they were going to give in and they said, hey, we're going to adopt. And at 6 years old, this sounds really fucking cool. Because suddenly, like, I get a kid that I can instantly go out and play with. Like, I don't have to do the diapers and the baby stuff. Like, I can get a kid my age. We could just have fun. This would be great. Excellent. So I don't know how adoptions work these days, but back then, and this is like in the early 80s, you like would go to a place, you'd meet a couple kids. If you liked one, then they'd come home for a day or two. Then they go back, and then they come back for a week or two, and then they go back and forth until finally they stayed for like 6 months. And then after that 6 month period, then, you know, both parties would decide if you wanted to stay together. So we went to this place, and I met a couple kids, and they were younger than me or about my age. And I don't know, like, we just didn't hit it off. They were kind of boring. They were really square. And I was really square, so if I was super nerd. So if I was really square, then they were doubly square. And then we went, like, so at the time I was living in Plainfield, New Jersey, which is, you know, at the time was kind of suburby. But then we went down to, I don't want to say an orphanage, but an adoption center in Newark, New Jersey. And back then, Newark was the ghetto. It was hardcore. Like, you didn't go to Brick City at all unless you absolutely had to. But we went down there and we met this kid, and his name was Lawan. And from the minute I met him, like, I loved this kid. He was so cool. I mean, he knew how to talk to women, the little girls that were walking around. He had cool sneakers on. They were beat up and ugly, but they were cool. I mean, he was just cool. And when my parents walked away, he was cursing with me. I was like, this is great. Like, I never cursed in my life. He taught me how to say motherfucker. That was amazing. So I loved this kid, and he would come to the house, and we hung out, and then we did the whole, you know, six-month thing when he was there, and that was good. We did a lot of traveling. We ended up going to see family all over to introduce him to family and see how that was going. And when he got there, you know, I had just gotten this brand-new bike, this BMX bike that I loved, but I still have my old bike. So now that I got my brother, you know, I let him use my new bike, and I would just take my old one. So it was cool, and everything was going well. We decided that we were going to go through with the adoption. Great. So we do the adoption. Everything's fine. I've already taken him around the neighborhood, but now that he is my brother, I want to reintroduce him to everybody because I am so proud. And when I introduce him to all the kids, they love him. They think he's cool. Again, he's like teaching us how to smoke cigarettes that were on the ground. It was disgusting, but we thought it was cool. So nasty. I totally have this image of like picking up this cigarette with lipstick on it and smoking it. Like, so, you know, my brother was the epitome of cool. But down the road, just a little bit outside of our neighborhood, was the cul-de-sac. And, like, I didn't even really know what a cul-de-sac was. I just knew if someone said the cul-de-sac, where they were talking about, and you stayed the hell away from the cul-de-sac. Because at the cul-de-sac was a kid named Gerard. And Gerard was older than us. He was 16, and he was the neighborhood bully. And everybody in this cul-de-sac was his family. So you couldn't go down there and mess with him because he had a ready-made army. And he would come through our little neighborhood and just terrorize everybody. And we were all scared to death of Gerard. Nobody ever went down there. But now I've got a cool big brother. And I'm 7. My brother is 10. And side note, really weird that my parents adopted an older kid. Really fucking weird. I'm a parent now, and I'm just like, what the hell were you thinking? I mean, that just does not make any damn sense. But whatever. Back to the story. Now, I got an older brother, you know? I mean, Luan is 10, and we're going down to the cul-de-sac, damn it, because I'm going to show him off. So we get down there, and all of Gerard's cousins were out there, and Gerard was there, and I introduced my brother, and Gerard and my brother just stared at each other like two pit bulls. They just circled and really didn't say anything. And then Gerard started picking on me like he normally does. You know, he would talk about my shoes and talk about my bike. Now, my old bike was light blue, and he just loved to talk about how light blue and corny it was. Anyway, so my brother did not like this kid picking on me, and my brother gets into his face, and Luan starts talking bad to him and telling him that he better watch his mouth, and me and my little friends are like, ooh, for the first time, Gerard is getting it. And then Gerard, the 16-year-old, balled his fists and punched my brother, the 10-year-old, in the face. And my brother falls on the ground like a sack of potatoes. And everybody just can't believe what just happened. And Gerard moves in. Now, his family comes and grabs him to restrain him. And my brother, who is 10 years old, gets up and he is ready to fight. Like, he is not scared. He is not crying. He doesn't care. He is determined he is going to whip Gerard's ass. But not going to happen. His family separates us, put us on our bike, and we start to ride away. And my brother looks at Gerard and he says, I'm going to come back. I'm going to get you. So we rode away. And as we're riding off, I'm like, damn, he is a badass. He just got punched in the face. And he's talking about he's coming back. So my brother told me, do not say anything to my mother. I was like, cool, whatever. That night, we're in our room, in our brand new bunk beds. And I'm telling my brother, like, yo, Gerard's a jerk. Don't worry about him. I'm trying to comfort him and everything. And my brother is so mad. Like, he hasn't talked the whole time since we've been home. And he gets down off of the top bunk, and he comes over to me, and he grabs me, and he says, the only reason why I stayed here is because I wanted your bike. And then he proceeds to beat my ass. And when I tell you he beat my ass, my brother was very skilled. Like, he didn't hit me in the face. He only did body blows that hurt like a motherfucker. But, you know, he made sure that there were no marks. And I remember sitting in the bed crying, trying to decide if I was going to tell my mother. And I thought, like, if I tell my parents, then they were going to send Luan back. And if I told them and they didn't send him back, then he was going to beat me again. So I thought, okay, I'm just not going to say anything because, you know, I wanted this kid to be my brother. For the next 3 years, my brother continued to beat me up on a regular. If he thought I told on him, he would beat me up. If he thought I scraped his shoes, he would beat me up. If he had a bad day at school, he would come home and beat me up. And this was just the normal thing. Back in the day, we used to watch karate flicks, and I don't know if any of you did this in your neighborhood, but in New Jersey, we would Saturday mornings, we'd watch karate flicks, and then we'd go in the street and try to do kung fu on each other. My brother could out-kung fu every damn body in the neighborhood, and he somehow got some Chinese stars, and he decided that, like, I was going to be his practice. And the thing is, like, when he tells you that I'm going to practice with you, you don't have a choice because he'd throw them at you either way. So either you stand still and hope he doesn't hit you, or you try to run away and you definitely get hit. These were the kind of things that happened for the next 3 years. And then my parents come and tell us that they are pregnant and having a baby. What the fuck? You're having a baby? For a kid 3 years ago, and they're having a baby now. So literally within 3 years, I go from being an only child to a middle child. Who does that happen to? So here I am, middle child, and my parents decide that we need a bigger house now, so we have to move. So we start packing everything up to go. They found a house, whatever. The last day we're in the neighborhood, my parents tell me, you guys go out, ride your bikes, say goodbye to your friends, blah, blah, blah. All right. So we get out the house, and we're going to the bikes, and my brother grabs me, and he says, look, I want you to ride down to the cul-de-sac and start a fight with Gerard. Hell no, I'm not going down there to fight Gerard. If you don't fight Gerard, I'm going to fight you. Now, at this point, I'm 10 years old, and I've begun to learn the game of how to stay away from the pit bull that is my brother and how to keep him happy. And I realized if I didn't go down there to start the fight with Gerard, then my brother was going to beat me up. And it was a calculated risk. Gerard might kill me, but my brother would torture me for the rest of my life, and I'd rather have a quick death. So I figured, fine, I would just do it. So I got on my bike and rode to the cul-de-sac by myself, and that was the longest ride. And when I got down there, Gerard is out. He's older now. He's 19. He's still got his cousins. They're all hanging. I'm a little 10-year-old kid. I put my bike down, and I go over, and I just start talking mess to Gerard. I specifically remember that I said to Gerard, like, your mother wears combat boots. I think that was a thing back then, but I don't know why. So, you know, I'm talking all of this smack, and Gerard is just getting more angry, you know? And I could see him begin to move in. Now, what I didn't know at the time is that my brother had left the house and gone the opposite direction and gone from behind the block. And behind the block, there was a park. Now, in that park, it connected, it went right up into the back of the cul-de-sac. My brother rode into the park, parked his bike, climbed up a hill, waited behind a house, and he could see everything that was going on. He was just hidden. And so as Gerard moved in and got really close to me, my brother ran from behind one of the houses. Gerard's moving in on me. My brother taps his shoulder. And when Gerard turns around, my brother turns to him with a brick in his hand and bashes him in the head. Gerard falls on the ground, blood gushing out. My brother begins to kick him really hard, looks down on him and says, I told you don't mess with the Letson boys. I swear to God, I'm not lying. Everybody is speechless because they are watching this little maniac kick this kid. And finally, when the days wears off, people begin to move towards us. My brother grabs me, throws me on the handlebars of my little blue bike, and we ride all the way home. We get home. My parents are pretty much done. We pack stuff up. I put my bike in the back. My brother tells him he left his bike in the park. They drive around, pick up his bike, and we go to our new house. That night, we're in the new house, and everything is strange. Like, the sounds are different. I've just watched my brother, like, bust some dude's head open. Like, literally, I thought Gerard was dead, you know? And it was just this really surreal moment. And I remember sitting in the bed, being really quiet, because I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to upset my brother. I didn't want him to come down and bash me in the head. But he leaned over, and he looked at me, and he said, for the rest of your life, nobody is ever going to pick on you again. Now, he probably should have said, for the rest of your life, nobody but me is going to pick on you again. And for the rest of my teenage years, my brother held true. Whenever there was a problem, my pit bull would come out and attack and take care of me. He'd also beat my ass later on, but he always took care of me. And I realized that, yeah, I had adopted a pit bull, but that pit bull was always my brother. Thank you.
Keep it going for Al Letson. I was adopted too. I always wished I had a brother. So I don't know if you're in the market for a third one.
Let's do it.
Okay, we'll sort out the details backstage. You know what impressed me the most about that story is when his brother said, "Leave no marks." That's something that they say like in spy films. And this kid's 10 and he already knows about that. You adopted like a 10-year-old Ernst Stavros Blofeld. Are you guys having fun? All right. All right, this guy, George R.R. Martin here, is is really digging it. I'm going to tell you what one of my biggest fears is. I'm afraid of having all the tools I need to compete and still not being able to compete. When I was 18 years old, I was fed up with the staggering amount of sex that I was not having. So I came up with a solution. I would lose my virginity to a hooker. Now, I got the contact info from my crystal meth friend, Crystal Meth Alex. He was part of that world, like Ariel. And what he said to me was, this is a pager, you dial it, leave your phone number, and somebody will call you back. So I rushed home and locked myself inside my parents' office, which was the only room in the house with a caller ID box. And I dialed, and I waited. And before too long, the phone rang, and nervously I snatched it up, you know, looking around the locked room to make sure I was still alone. I just, grabbed it, and I was like, hello? And I don't know what voice I was looking to come out of the other end of that phone. Like, if I thought it was going to be some 1940s Biloxi Blues madam spraying perfume all through the parlor, who just, pick it up and be like, hello. But the voice that came out was, hey, how are ya? It was bright. It was chipper. It was the female version of me, which is essentially all I'm looking for in the first place. So I said, hello. And she said, hey, how are you? And then a third voice came on the line. It was my father. Because you know how people are when they're old and confused, and they think if the phone has rang any time in the last hour, then there's a good chance someone is still waiting for the line to be picked up. So I said, hello. And she said, hey, how are you? And then Dad goes, hello. And I said, I got it, Dad. And he goes, all right. You okay? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. You can hang up. And he goes, well, are you going to be home for supper tonight? Because your mom is cooking roast beef and Yorkshire puddings. And I'm like, I am figuring out right now if I'm going to be around. You can hang up the phone. And he goes, okay, I'll let you go then. And he hangs up, and the plans are made. I am going to the Baymont Hotel by Cleveland Hopkins Airport to meet the woman who will take my virginity. And you guys, to me, this was so romantic. It was so romantic. It was, because I was naive. I was immature. I didn't know how things worked. Like, in my mind, I thought, okay, all right, this girl has maybe taken a few wrong turns, but once she meets me, sees the purity emanating from my heart, well, then she will quit this line of work and we will run off together and have a million babies. That was my attitude going in. As far as I was concerned, that was the most likely outcome of this encounter. And my heart was just soaring as I pulled into the Baymont. I was singing along to my favorite romantic song at the time, which was Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground by Willie Nelson. But it wasn't the Willie Nelson version I was listening to. It was my high school band covering it with me on lead vocals. So as I'm pulling into the Baymont, I'm singing at the top of my lungs to me, singing back to myself, and I see a police cruiser slowly patrolling the lot. And I'm like, oh, fuck, is this a bust? Is this a bust? Am I being set up? And I park, and I gather myself together, and I'm scared. But the glory of love gives me the courage to get out of my car and walk into the Baymont. And I don't know if any of you ever have to walk in front of a cop when you're planning on doing something wrong, but whenever it's me, I'm always like, okay, just walk like normal. Walk like you're not going to do anything wrong. And I feel like I'm not walking right. And I'm like, well, how does an innocent person walk? I think an innocent person walks like this. And I got to the door, and I went into the lobby, and everyone's eyes were on me. It was like there was a gust of wind from their collective wide eye opening. They just went like... And I become super aware of my environment. I go into this William Faulkner sensory overload. Like every sound, every smell, every sight, I'm seeing them all at once and individually. And I look over, and by the check-in desk, there's a well-dressed man. And he looks at someone that I can't see. And he goes, and then he starts to follow me. And I get in the elevator, and he gets in the elevator. And I push a button to my floor, and he doesn't push a button. As the elevator doors open, I see that there's no twists or turns in this hallway. It's just one long corridor that goes all the way back. And as I pass each door, and he's not going in any of them, I get more and more scared. And finally, I get to the room at the very end of the hall, which is the room I'm going to. And he stops at the one right next to it. And as I'm knocking on my door and he's keying his, we look over at each other. And I don't know who this guy is, but he had to know that there was something shady going on. And when he left me alone in the hallway, I thought again, is this a bust? Is this something doesn't smell right? I'm just going to cut my losses and get out of here. I'm just going to go right now. And right as I was about to leave, the door opened and she was there and I forgot about everything. Now, I'm not going to be crass. I am not going to describe to you what she was wearing. But if you were an 18-year-old looking to lose your virginity to a hooker, you would not be disappointed. And the next thing I noticed was like, oh my God, she's old. She is old. She is so old. Like 23, which was super old to me at the time. Like, if the 2014 version of me was to run into this girl, I'm sure I'd be like, Jesus Christ, you're just a fucking baby. What are you doing with your life? Come on, we'll sort this out. There's better options for you. You don't need to do this. But at the time, I was like, oh, there is a maturity and sophistication coming out of this woman that I will never be able to match. And I'm not good at describing makeup, but it was like... It was harsh. Does that make any sense? It was like really angular and caked on. Like if someone was to throw a dart at her face, it would just like stick in the side and she wouldn't even feel it. And that's when I realized, oh, there's nothing romantic about this at all. She's not going to run away with me and have a million babies. To her, this is just a business transaction. And again, I get scared. And as I walk in the room, I give myself a silent pep talk. I'm like, okay, we're switching gears. We're going to plan B. You do not need to impress this person. You do not need to tell her your life story. You are here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to take care of business. 1 minute later, I'm in the room going, well, ultimately, what I would like to do is direct. I give her the money. It's 6 weeks' worth of paychecks from Mammoth Video. She tells me to take off my clothes and lay on the bed. So I do. I take off my clothes, and I lay on the bed, face down. And... And she straddles me like around my waist and starts massaging me with lotion, and I just lock up, like except for the occasional like spasm, because I had never been touched before. I mean, I'd been hit, but I had never been sensually touched. And in my head, I'm like, I'm being touched. This is what being touched is like. Does this feel good? Is this supposed to feel good? I heard touching feels good. I don't know if I feel good. Why don't I know what I feel? Somebody tell me what I feel. When the massage portion of the evening was over, I silently slid off the bed and grabbed a condom out of my jeans, which I had brought along very considerately, not realizing she would have 35,000 of them up on the desk. And this was my first condom, so I'm like, all right, where am I supposed to tear this? And there was this look in her eyes that just said, game over. And she goes, I can't do this. And I said, what do you mean you can't do this? You have to do this. I paid you to do this. We are going to do this. And I don't know if she really believed this or if she was just fishing for an excuse, but she goes, how do I know you're not a cop? And I said, cop? What is this, 21 Jump Street? I'm 18 years old. I'm stick thin. I don't even look like I'm old enough to drive. I am not a cop. And I can sense that this is rapidly spiraling out of my control, and I'm desperate to salvage it. So I ask what I felt to be a reasonable question. I said, do you have any friends you could recommend? And again, she says, how do I know you're not a cop? So I show her my driver's license, which is a brilliant move on my part, because as everybody knows, police officers do not get driver's licenses. You know, as soon as you get the gun and the badge, the captain is like, I will take that license from you, thank you very much. And so I said, look, I paid you for the hour. Are you telling me we're through? And she says, and I'll never forget this, not unless you want to conversate. And I didn't want to conversate. But what I did want was value for my money. So I stayed in the room the entire hour, did not say one word to her. We just watched Sally, Jesse, Raphael. And at this point, what little masculinity that I had was just obliterated. I mean, I had the hotel room. I had the money. I had the hooker. I had the penis. I had all the tools I needed to compete. And I still could not compete. And to this day, whenever I see any of my Ohio friends, they still call me Beowulf can't get a hooker to fuck him Jones. Thank you. In case anyone is wondering, no, I have not had sex yet, but I'm keeping a positive attitude, and I think some things are coming together, and I'm really, you know, this is gonna happen. Thank you. Okay, let's keep it going. I'm so excited for our next performer. She is amazing. She hosts a Maximum Fun podcast called Oh No with Ross and Carrie. We can clap for that. She's performed with the Groundlings. She's performed at UCB. Let's just get her up here. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Carrie Poppy.
Hello, everybody. My story starts when I was 27, which was 3 years ago, if you're curious. It starts when I came home one day. I had been gone on a work trip for exactly 23 hours, very short work trip. And I came home to my tiny studio guest house that I lived in. There was a whole glass window that went from the floor to the ceiling in my guest house. And that whole thing had been bashed in. I walked up and I saw glass all over and I thought, oh my God, did someone break in? I opened my door. And there was glass everywhere, and my dogs were walking in it, and their paws were all cut up. And there was trash all over the floor. There were open medicine bottles everywhere. And I thought, oh my God, what has happened? Like, a crazy person's been in my house. Someone has broken in. And as I walked in, there were pictures on the wall, drawings, and they were in this very tight, very well-executed hand. Like, I mean, an artist had drawn these, but they were of, one was of Hello Kitty, but she was, it was like goth Hello Kitty, and she was slitting her wrists. And then another one was of this man, this young man with a full erection, and he was sitting in a chair and smoking a cigarette and jacking off. And this is just taped, like, to my wall. And I thought, oh my God, what the hell has happened? But the story doesn't really start there. The story really starts when I was a kid. I grew up with a sister. Her name's Laura. And when we were growing up, she was like the super genius one. Whenever I went to school and had a teacher that she had had, they'd be like, oh my gosh, you're Laura's sister. Are you as smart as she is? Which is like a lot to live up to. So I learned to say things like, I'm almost as great. And then I felt like all the bars lowered. So then if I'm like close enough, it'll be fine. But she was wonderful and inspiring. And we shared this love of books. Together, we would sit at the breakfast table. And my mom had to actually develop a rule, no books at the table. Because we would both bring our books and read them at the table. And then like, converse and talk about the books, share notes. And my mom was finally like, no, we're going to have family time. There's no reading. But as we grew up, we sort of grew apart, I suppose, as many siblings do. She's 3 years older. She went to college 1 year early. When she went off to college, she did start writing me letters. And we developed this whole new relationship about looking back into our past, at our childhood. And she started talking about the hardships we'd both gone through. Our dad was an alcoholic. Our parents were both pretty absent. And so she would write me these letters, these very reassuring letters. And I remember her saying, education was my way out, and it's your way out too. And I really clung to that, and I made sure to get really good grades in school so I could get out of there. But then, when I was in my mid-20s and my sister was 30, she had a very terrible breakup. She had been in a relationship for 15 years, so from when she was 15 to when she was 30. And he broke up with her, and she sort of spiraled into depression, and she ended up losing her job for stealing things from her job. So she didn't know what to do. She didn't know where to go. She lived in New York City, where you can't not have a job for a month without dying. So I said, well, come live with me in LA. Sleep on my couch until you find something else. And of course, I was working in a nonprofit. I lived in this tiny studio guest house, but she's my sister. What are you going to do? So she comes, she stays on my couch, and pretty much just smoked pot the whole time, I would say. But it was great in its own way. We got to talk about our childhood. We got to talk about the years that had happened since then and what her life was like and what my life was like. And one of the things that really struck us is that when we were growing up, she was a hardened atheist. She didn't believe in anything spiritual or religious. And I was very, very religious. But at this point, we had flipped. And I was an atheist, and she had started believing in these sort of like new age spiritual beliefs, and she had become an astrologer. So that was like really interesting conversations we were having about these changes, and we stayed up at night talking about them. And then the next day she wouldn't remember them, but they were great. Then one day she came home and she said, I want you to start calling me Math. And I said, okay, Math, what? And she said, well, math is like words set on fire. And I said, uh-huh. Okay, Math, will do. And then I started getting a little concerned about her, but she still seemed okay, maybe. And that's about when I went on this trip. I went on this 23-hour work trip. When I came home, that window was bashed in. My dogs were walking in the glass. And when I came in, I said, Math? Math? Are you here? Math? Laura? Math? And no answer. And I thought my sister had been killed. Something horrible had happened here. And I found a letter on my desk. And it said, Dear Carrie, sorry about your window. I'll explain in 4 to 7 years, but I have to go do something, and you won't hear from me until then. And love math. I called my mom and I told her this whole story, and we're like, we have to find her. We have to figure out what happened. And she said, well, do you know if she had anywhere to go? Does she have a job lined up yet? And I said, oh yes, that's right. She does have a job lined up. Okay. Yes. She told me just a couple days ago that she got a job, cleaning up cum at a bathhouse in San Francisco, I think. Which is true. And my mom was like, great. So, and by the way, her name's Math now. Okay, got it. So we're both looking for bathhouses in San Francisco, trying to find someone named Math. And both of us are coming up dry. And say Risk is a show about people coming together. So I swear that wasn't intentional. But we both can't find her. So I'm going through like all these possibilities, and I start telling my mom about the things Math has told me while she was staying. And one of the things I had learned was that she is bisexual. I never knew that. And that she didn't consider herself particularly gendered. She still went by her, but she didn't, consider herself to have a particular gender, one or the other. And so I shared all this stuff with my mom. We're kind of trying to piece together her story, like what's happened here. And then Math wrote to my mom. And she said, she blamed her for all the bad things that had happened in her life, and to make a long story short, said the same thing to her. I have to go do something. I'll be back in 4 to 7 years. You won't hear from me till then. So I said, okay, you know what? We have to cut this person out. If she's going to behave like this, if she's going to
bash in my window and not explain what happened. Like, we need to cut this person loose until they have their shit together. So then I get an email from Math, and she says, I just want to tell you, I did intentionally break your window. And the reason I did it is that when I found out you were an atheist, my fist got mad. And I was standing outside your apartment, and I just felt it go up and hit the glass. So I said, okay, well, you know, if I were Muslim or I were Christian, you'd identify that as a hate crime, right? So that's what this is. And you're not welcome here. And until you want help getting help, you know, we can't be in contact. So that was 3 years ago now. And all that time had passed with me not talking to Math. I didn't hear from her at all until about 3 weeks ago. I decided I needed to know what was going on. I wanted to know that she was okay, that she was alive even. And I started just thinking, like, well, what even takes 4 to 7 years? Like, that's such a specific little window. And I thought, I guess like a sex change takes that long. Maybe it's that. I don't know. So I did what any rational person would do. I drove the hundreds of miles from Los Angeles to San Francisco with no plan to go find Math in a city of thousands of people. And I went up there and I stayed with my friends Allie and John, a married couple. We went to the Castro and we started walking into bathhouses. And we found it. We found the one Math worked at. And we got in and we froze, because what do you do in a bathhouse? We don't know. And so Allie and I, the two women, both kind of just stopped there thinking, like, this is an all-men's bathhouse. I don't know what to do. So my friend John, who's never been in a situation like this before, is staying there with his wife and his friend, walked up to the window and he said, three, please. and the guy behind the counter went, this is a bathhouse. And he said, yes. And he said, well, your friends can't come in. And he said, oh, okay. So we walked out, all, you know, despondent. And I said, is that it? Did I come to San Francisco just to walk into a bathhouse and walk out? And I said, no, I'm going back in. So I walk back in, march up to the window, and I say, is Math here? And he said, oh, no, he's not. He actually couldn't come in today, so I'm subbing for him. And I tried not to show any surprise at the pronouns. And I said, okay, could you tell him that his sister came? I'm actually his sister. And every possible human emotion showed on this guy's face. He looked surprised and then confused and then like utter disgust. He had clearly said some very angry things about me. And he just looked down and he said, yeah, okay, I'll tell him. And I started walking away and I said, I love him. And then I walked out. And I haven't heard from Math at all since then. It's only been a few weeks. But I guess in the end, this is a story about my brother. And I hope that I hear from him again soon.
That is all for this week, folks. This is Group Love behind me now. And don't forget that we are in Chicago, Illinois on July 22nd, 2014. We are at the thrust space. But to find out more, you can always go to risk-show.com/tour. And then again, of course, on July 24th, we are at our normal spots of residence, The Pit in New York and the Nerd Melt Theater in Los Angeles. That's both on July 24, 2014. So come out and see us. Make sure to look for us online, also on Twitter and Facebook, at Risk Show. On Twitter, I am at The Kevin Allison. And remember, Risk is a proud member of the Maximum Fun network of podcasts, and we very much are listener-supported. We rely on the financial help of our fans. So go to MaximumFun.org/donate and become a member or make a one-time donation. And be sure to earmark your contribution for Risk. Don't forget also, folks, that we teach storytelling at thestorystudio.org. All sorts of different ways to get in on that. Well, with all that said, I guess that is about it. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.